Doug, you can take one. Doug, if you want, just right behind. Okay, so I think we're going to try to get the evening started, actually shockingly on time. So if you don't mind, just if you have a cell phone, if you could turn that off now, that'd be terrific. So welcome to the Drawing Center. I'm Brett Lippman, the executive director and also the curator of Leon Golub, Live and Die Like a Lion. And we're here tonight for a panel discussion, which includes an esteemed group of artists, curators, art critics, and colleagues who are going to share their personal experiences and recollections of Leon. What I asked each panelist to do was to choose one drawing from the exhibition and to use that as the springboard for a discussion about Leon's work and their relationship to the artist and to the legacy of Leon. The panelists will include, in order of speaking, Susan Harris, an independent curator and writer, Doug Dryspoon, the chief curator at the Albright Knox Museum in Buffalo, Sam Koontz, who worked with Leon and Nancy for many, many years, an artist and the studio assistant, and Robert Storr, artist critic and dean of the School of Art at Yale University. To begin with, I just wanted to talk very briefly about curating this exhibition. For me, the exhibition really begins and ends with the canvas behind me. The idea was that drawing is quite fundamental to Leon's work. In the paintings, it was very difficult, although surely readable, that there was a drawn understructure. Leon's technique of using source material or a projector to create the form and then to draw that form and then to paint over it and to scrape and to really work that surface often obscured the drawing itself. This canvas was on Leon's studio wall from 2001 to 2004, and it's the only existing that I know of canvas that is unfinished, where you can clearly see the drawing. The two lions, of course, the show is called Live and Die Like a Lion? Obviously is an important idea, an icon in the late drawings. And for me, these works really became very interesting. The first work that I saw was Alarm Dog Encountering Pink, which is the last work on the wall, the far wall there. And I thought, wow, that can't be by Leon Golub. It was kind of funny, light. The scale of it was totally different from the heroic paintings. And that began an investigation, which has been ongoing now for about a year and a half, of finding drawings, the drawings made between 1999 and 2004, with the help of Martina Batan from Feldman Gallery, and Sam as well in the studio. It turns out that there were about 440 drawings made between 1999 and 2004. To give a sense of the breakdown, we have one work from 1999, two works from 2000, three works from 2001, including the canvas, 16 works from 2002, 13 works from 2003, and eight works from 2004. Of the 43 total works in the show, I just want to talk very briefly about the kinds of works that are in the exhibition. There are six lion or sphinx drawings, four skeletons or skull drawings, 15 erotic drawings, six political drawings, six dog drawings, three satyr drawings. So when I was looking at the exhibition, I really wanted to kind of keep the ratio relatively consistent with what I thought the whole oeuvre of work would look like from 1999 to 2004. I could have done a show of just lions, we could have only done erotic work, but it was very important to me to place these works in this kind of complex amalgam of freer, de-skilled, fractured, and difficult works. In a way, if you know Leon's work, I think that these works come as a little bit of a surprise because they are, I think, quite funny. I think that they're slightly lighter in subject matter. And of course, the self-reflexive nature and the kind of turning the mirror back on the artist himself as the subject matter, possibly, of these drawings is a very important move. Lastly, the show is curated really by color, so the way that this is organized is not chronologically, and many people have asked about the color of the wall. This is not a color that Leon had used in his paintings, but we did look at some old paint cans that Sam had provided us with, and I thought within the family of colors that Leon might have used in paintings in the 70s and 80s that this color might be appropriate, and as well, Leon very clearly stated that these drawings should be kind of tensioned off the paper, so I took that one step further and thought about tensioning them off the wall. And I'm actually very pleased. I mean, this could be a real career killer to paint the walls pumpkin, which is not, it's not quite pumpkin, but it's worked out, I think, quite well, because it also really makes the drawings kind of pop and stand out. So with that said, there are four major things that I mention in my essay. We do have a very nice catalog for the show, which is available up front. I've written an essay, and also Eduardo Cadava, who's teaching at Princeton. And in my essay, I mention four things. Eros is being extremely important in these drawings. The scale, the diminutive scale of them. They're all 8 by 10 or 10 by 8, except for the one drawing called Fuck Death, which is slightly smaller, maybe coming out of a sketchbook. The relationship of Leon to the animal world, particularly lions and dogs, which play a very important role in this body of work. And the inclusion of handwritten text on every single one of these drawings, which often, in a way, kind of cancel out sometimes the visual image, or at least create a playful nature between the image and the text itself. So without further ado, Susan, if you're ready, we'll start the panel discussion. Thank you again for coming.
Well, Brett asked us each to select a drawing, and I selected the drawing he mentioned that he first saw, which is Alarm Dog Encountering Pink. And I wanted to choose a dog drawing because it took me back to a trip that I took with Nancy and Leon when Nancy had a show in Sweden at the Malmö Kunsthall. I had written the exhibition catalog text, and Nancy had asked me to join them and help with the installation. And I remember Sam was there, and I remember we were all standing in this very long skylit space, and Leon kept cracking these very corny jokes that we thought was pretty funny but got increasingly obnoxious, and particularly so for Nancy. And so I don't know exactly who suggested it or how it all happened, but all of a sudden Leon was gone. And it turns out that he was sent to a room with paper and materials and to draw. And it was sort of like a kid, you know, being sent, you know, to, you know, be distracted and not bother the grown-ups. So while we continued with the installation downstairs, Leon was upstairs by himself, and he made this series of drawings of on 10 by 8 inch pieces of paper. And I think they were the first of their kind and predates this whole series of works that he started in the late 90s. And at one point during that that installation, Leon invited me upstairs to see what he was doing, and I was pretty startled to see these drawings of dogs, and they were all of dogs. They were dogs, sometimes there were two. I have to say I'm very fortunate in that he ended up giving me one of these drawings that I love. And they were usually on, you know, on grounds that were very agitated and painterly surfaces. But the startling thing, obviously, even seeing them now in 2010, is that the pared down subject matter, just dog, and their intimate scale, and their spontaneity, and just sort of their liquid painterliness, were such a departure from the massive signature paintings he is known for with groupings of individuals that are not up to any good. And as Leon went through and showed me the drawings, I remember very distinctly his being as, you know, sort of struck and pleased by the personal qualities in those drawings, you know, as much as I was. And he was also telling me of drawings that he had done from the 40s, 50s, and 60s, which I hadn't really seen. I had only seen drawing evidenced in the prints he had done. And he said, you know, he had drawers full of them in the studio, which he promised he would show me, and he did, and subsequently I saw. But it was, you know, it just opened my eyes up to this whole other dimension of Leon. This particular drawing, Alarm Dog Encountering Pink, is full of the contradictions that I came to learn and love about Leon and his art. And I don't know if you've had a chance to take a look at it, but there are these open jaws of this wild-looking dog, and he goes head to head with this similarly shaped painterly passage, as if the passage is very clearly a humorous nod to abstraction. And above it are these three, you know, lines of paint, sort of a joking reference to minimalism, and in between which, sort of intersecting, are the lines of text, "Alarm dog encountering pink." And it's as if we're witnessing a face-off between representational content and abstract painting. And, I mean, I find it hilarious, especially given the art world's fickle stance toward figurative art from the 1950s on, and Leon's constant falling in and out of favor, depending upon how the art wind blew. But even with the humor, and Leon's inimitable humor in general, the dichotomy between content and formalist concerns that make it so funny underscores Leon's lifelong, really serious commitment to an art of figuration that acknowledges and encompasses the layered complexity of human nature and events. And I guess that's one of the most valuable things I learned from Leon, that it had to do with his constant awareness of the extreme discontinuity between this human history and aesthetics. And I remember when I first got Leon's work and got this sort of dichotomy and revealed, you know, sort of biases that I myself had had, because at the time I was more interested in art that was more poetic and conceptual and abstract. And I'm embarrassed to admit that I've kind of had blinders on to figurative art. But I remember walking into the gallery, it was down here in Soho, and seeing this painting show of Leon's. And when I looked at the paintings, I just felt like I was knocked in the solar plexus. It wasn't that I had never seen his work before, but I saw it for the first time. And that I felt all my preconceptions about the differences between figurative and abstract art seemed ludicrous. I remember being just stunned by the beauty of the unstretched canvases. In one, you know, with those red grounds of the mercenaries, and I'm pretty sure it was one of those, but this sort of flat but infinite red space that was such an eloquent and timeless ground for these strikingly painted figures. And then in the others, more contemporary at the time, in the mid-80s, where he sort of confounded the ground and the figure through this overall textured physicality. And then there was a beginning of blurring of physical gesture and expression. And years later, because I didn't know Leon that well then, I had just begun to know him, I told him about my epiphany, about his art, but really about figurative art in general, that I actually arrived at narrative figurative art having been drawn in by the complex formal relations between space and surface and cropping and narrative meaning in his paintings. And I came to value and celebrate the moral and aesthetic imperatives in his art and the timeless beauty in his art and other so many other painters that I had kind of blocked out of my vision and that I hadn't really been able to see before. And then the dog in this particular drawing, but in so many of the dog drawings, conjures up all notions of dog. A dog is a loyal human companion. In many of the drawings, it's a threatening presence. And I think Brett mentions in his essay that in Leon's work, it's a post-apocalyptic survivor who roams the urban space. And for me, too, I have to say that even as we spoke about the lion being, Leon, Leon is a dog, and he's as a witness to the chaos in the world and the inexorability of decay and death. And the aggressive snapping dog in this particular drawing, an alarm dog, makes me think of Leon, not because he was vicious, because obviously he wasn't, but because of the anger he felt, and maybe only starting to feel at that time in 94, because even then, he was tired and he was scaling down his work, not only because he was traveling, but he was beginning to realize that his, you know, he didn't have the strength that he had had throughout his years of painting. And he joked about, you know, age and getting old sucks. But, you know, the reality was, is he was angry about getting old and the inevitability of dying. And so I'd say ferociousness, you know, the qualities in this dog, ferociousness, grace, and humor. And that's what I see in the drawing. And that's what I think about when I think of Leon, you know, as a man, as my friend, as an artist, whose presence and legacy in so many ways still lives very strongly within me.
The drawing reads, "Gunman caught in red abstraction, situation could be serious." Art was serious. Situations were serious for Leon. An artist was someone who wasn't just about making compelling paintings and works of art. It was about being responsible, being engaged socially, politically. And he spent a lot of time immersing himself in those life situations. The drawings are an interesting body of work because at that point in Leon's life, and as Susan mentioned, unable to scrape, get on his knees, paint, re-scrape, tackle a large canvas, he took to paper because paper was easy. And actually, I think about Matisse in Old Age and the jazz cutouts. At a point when one is laboring to lift a brush, the paper represents a very malleable and fluid kind of medium. And given the scale of things in this case, in Leon's case, something that you can throw away if it doesn't work. So at a point in his life where he was able to draw and return to drawing, and he had always drawn, it wasn't like he had never drawn before, it was just something that took on a new kind of life for him. Susan talked about abstraction, and that's something I want to dig into a little bit too. If you look at the major works, the mercenary paintings, the White Squad, Horsing Around, look to the backgrounds. And if you take the figures out of the image, you've got a pretty remarkable, in some cases, monochromatic ground, but in other cases, a ground that's full of abstract passages. Leon understood abstraction the way any good artist would understand it, as a way to build an image, as a formal quest, as a way to create an image out of formal elements. And it was something he took very seriously. But it was also something that he recognized that if it were the only thing, or that is the only part of your image, it could easily get solipsistic and self-referential. And so in 1955, he writes a piece that is a critique of abstract expressionism. It was published in the Art Journal. It's a pretty ballsy thing to write. But he wrote it from Chicago. So, I mean, in a way, he wasn't deep in the seat of the New York School. He wrote it from outside the gates, as he would say. That said, by the time he got to New York City, no one wanted to be his friend in that circle. But it didn't matter, because he always maintained that stance of being slightly on the outside, always critical, always skeptical, always reading, always digesting, an image monger in so many ways. And the drawings are full of that. They're full of the happiness of just taking a chance and stretching out, you know, experimenting in a way that if you're painting, you can't do in the same way. Or if you do, it's just a different kind of process. The humor part of it is of interest to me because the last couple of times Leon and I got together, we talked about humor. And I had always expected that he would join me on a CAA panel about humor. And so I was going to him, and actually he was one of the first persons I went to because I needed some primer. And I always considered him very wise. And so I knew that if I went to Leon, that I would get the dope straight up, and he would give me some good ideas, and we would have an exchange. And sure enough, we had a great exchange. in older age, you can afford to be more humorous. I think in Leon's case, he always had a biting, wicked sense of humor. It was always there, but he was seriously and politically and socially engaged. And so the humor, as with abstraction, you find around the edges. It creeps in as abstraction crept in to the arena of an otherwise socially and politically engaged creative human being. They're not one-liners. The humor that he uses is distilled. He was very adept at coming up with titles before he went to sleep, walking on the streets, looking at graffiti. I mean, the sources are known. He spoke about them. But what I find fascinating is that images came into being as images first. And then the words might be applied, although he might have been thinking about a title as he was working an image up. But the point is, they're two discrete realms of reality. And when they come together, they create another kind of world. I loved his sense of humor. And when I did the panel, one of the things I did was I culled out something he said from that conversation, which was, you know, a sense of humor may be the one way you keep yourself kind of, it's a philosophical, repeat his exact words, but it may be one of the most facile and agile and philosophical ways to approach life. And he said, coming from me, that's a statement. So the drawings reveal a part and a personality, a part of the personality of this, of an artist who we tend to think of as very serious. And when Leon came to the Albright Knox and we did a panel, people came up to me afterwards, and John Bird was there as well, and they said, you know, he's very funny, you know, which the dichotomy and the split between the work and the personality, unless you knew him or unless you went to a panel, you would look at the work and say, yes, he's incredibly serious, and he was, but like any great artist, you know, and like a life well lived, it's a multi-headed, very complex personality that feeds the work. Thank you.
I came by yesterday morning just to have another look to be sure, you know, I know these drawings so well. Narrowing it down to one drawing was tough. So I walked around, and then, you know, Brett was here, and I said, you know what I really want to talk about is this one. This is the one that was hanging around for years, unfinished. He kind of wanted to finish it. So it was, you know, he wrestled with that, you know, he did not want to accept the fact that his elbow didn't want to do that anymore, and that his shoulder didn't have the range to work on that scale anymore. And he tried for some years to work smaller. He made several attempts to make sort of medium-sized paintings and was never satisfied with them. They weren't big enough. And I think it's interesting that later on, when he started working very small, they were very big. They really had that. They had the quality of a miniature that can contain a whole world. And somehow they were just as big as these, because you're drawn into them physically. I feel so privileged because over the years I saw a lot of paintings begin this way. And I saw a lot of great drawing going on. And I, you know, repeatedly saw him deliberately obliterate his facility, the evidence of his ability to draw in this classical manner. And you can see here how he began, how he worked it, how he reworked it, how he made the lion on the left's head was in proportion, and he's brought it down, and that condenses the image. That makes her head more intense. The expressions are so human in the eyes. Now that occurred over and over again in the original drawings, and then he would set about flattening, brightening, abstracting, if you will, masking off hard edges with masking tape, making layers and layers, and then scraping it all down to reveal a kind of essence that he accepted as a kind of conceptual work, I think, is, you know, well, it reveals itself. He set up the structure, then he stripped it away, and then magically, I did a lot of that scraping with him on the floor with the alcohol and the fans, and it was freezing cold and on our knees, and alcohol and, you know, and scraping. And when you pushed away the muck and this thing revealed itself, it's not even as if he figured it out. It just, he set it up and then it happened. So, you know, that was a kind of great magic that happened over and over. And I was always, though, a little sad to see that you know, that great drawing disappear. But it was very consistent, I think, with a determination he had to interrupt himself. And he did that in order to get at something else, to disrupt expectation. And he did it also, I think, as a way of coming to terms with his own personal awkwardness. He wanted the work to be as awkward as he felt within his body and himself. And he had always thought of himself as awkward, and he wasn't. I mean, that's the oddest thing is, you know, he was so full of personal grace and artistic grace, intellectual grace, but somehow he was right. You know, he was right to make those constructs and tear them apart and leave us with these unfamiliar creatures that were strictly Galubian. You know, they're unmistakable. When he finally found this little format to work on, it's as if his creative world just exploded. He was suddenly free to, as Doug said, really explore. He could throw it away. He didn't very often. He almost never had a failure. As his body got smaller and more restricted, it got focused into these little pages, and it just kept coming and coming and coming, and he started to whistle in the studio. He started to hum and whistle. You know, I'd hear him over there. He had the best time of his life. And he, I think he was really, really free, and he was in a hurry. I think he knew that time was limited, and he just let it rip. And the other thing I was thinking about with this painting was a little thing that happened one day in the 90s. He was making a series of large-scale Sphinx paintings, and there was a yellow Sphinx, a blue Sphinx, a red Sphinx. And my favorite was this red Sphinx painting that had a tall, strong Sphinx with his forearm crushing down on a crumpled man, the figure of a of the human, and the Sphinx had a human head, and it looked so resigned, and it looked so mournful for its role in this scenario. And the painting was exquisitely beautiful. It was this oxide color and deeper reds and blacks, and it was raw linen. So I walk into the studio one morning, and I always thought the night before that I knew what I was going to do the next day, and I would inevitably be disrupted when I got there. And so again, he says to me to take down the painting and cut it up. It's not working. He doesn't like it. And I couldn't talk him out of it. So that's what I did. I cut that up. And I say that because he didn't destroy this one. He knew he wasn't going to finish it. He knew he couldn't finish it. But here it is. So what I think is that he liked this drawing too. Thanks.
This get back from lots of interesting things have been said, and I'm sort of going to mull them in the back of my head and respond in a little bit extemporaneously, but talk about some of the same and some of the others. I saw this whole period of Leon's life by intermittent visits, but fairly regular. And I was aware of sort of the context around it, of his acceptance of the physical debility, and of his acute awareness of the limited amount of time. And there are many ways to tell the story of the end of an artist's life, you know. And I would think that these tell a story of an extremely active mind in an extremely limited physical reality. A couple of phrases sort of float to the surface. They're actually coming from other artists. A painting by Jasper Johns called Racing Thoughts. Two words that appear over and over and over again in Neon and Bruce Nauman: animal nature, human nature, animal nature, human nature. And a series of kind of... Yeah? Okay. I just hate these things, that's all. Just want to get a five. Okay. And here was a man who was acutely intelligent, acutely self-conscious in all the best ways, operating in the space of racing thoughts, operating in the space between human nature and animal nature, and also operating nocturnally. Leon and Nancy tended to work at night, tended to live at night for many cases, that in other ways also they had always lived in the nighttime parts of the 20th century and the dawning 21st. And that their concern was what happened in the shadows. Their concern was what happened in moments of despair. It was with all of the dark side, but with the dark side seen absolutely clearly, unadorned. And that in his work, that's what he strove to do. So in his way, racing thoughts include always a sort of alternating current of anger and of the kind of humor that's been talked about. As to the humor was lethal sometimes in its own way. It was not a gentle humor. It was not just a gallows humor. It was a humor meant to accomplish certain things, I think, to fight back, basically. And in circumstances where you can't win, fighting back with humor is a particularly poignant affair, and the fact that he is making jokes at his own expense about the frailty and mortality of his own body is a weapon. It's a weapon which is bound, as I say, to fail, but it's a weapon wielded with ever-increasing sort of ruthlessness all the way around. The sexual part is obviously of the same nature. That the loss of sexual vitality is not the loss of sexual imagination. Or maybe not even the loss of sexual vitality, just the loss of sexual opportunity. When your body won't do it anymore and nobody will do it with you, all that stuff has got to go someplace. And that if you look at Picasso's late drawings, and Leon was not a modest man. I mean, he very well knew that Picasso spent a good deal of his old age on dirty pictures, and I think probably would have consciously competed with Picasso for libidinous imagery. And one of the ways of competing it is to invent some new libidinous energy. So there's a drawing here where there is a female satyr with hairy legs. Picasso never did that. And there's some other stuff going on here that Picasso may have thought about, but he didn't draw. And you have a sense that there is, there is anger at the not being able to do it, and there's a sort of luxuriating in the ability to think about it and dream about it. And the whistling is not something I'd known about, but I think that's great. Whistle while you work, whistle while you die. But I would say one other thing on the thematic side, and then I'll shift gears. On the thematic side, as I say, Leon was very concerned with the dark parts of the last century into this century. And he made a huge gamble in the late 1970s, early 1980s, when he moved from the mythopoetic, allegorical, metaphoric representation of that to a straight description. When I first met him, actually, he was in probably the worst time of his life. It was the late 70s. He was making portrait heads of the people who have power in our society or who had them. And he was very close to quitting painting. He had his job in Rutgers, and he was, in a sense, set. But he was very, very discouraged. And he talked about it openly, which is unusual with artists. And the thing that he did after that was to, in a sense, paint what those guys did. And, of course, those guys means us guys also. And he painted a whole series of pictures, mercenaries and others, white squads, that were the only description we have in art of this period of the raw use of power in places where nobody is looking. And, of course, under present circumstances, we're fighting wars all over the place, but there are no reporters there to report on it. It would be impossible to have a My Life photograph now, probably. How do you portray what goes on offstage in shadows which are not actually night times and which are not actually natural phenomenon shadows that are created, in a sense, in order to mask what goes on. So the drawing I picked is the one in the back, which says Whereabouts Unknown. And it's an almost classical composition, and it is an image which shows up in many other forms elsewhere. It just seems crisper and harsher and better for that in that particular drawing. But if you think that for the period of 1980 until his death, Leon was one of the only political artists who, on the one hand, dared to do that. Number two, was able to do that without falling into a rhetoric or a politics that made the sting go away because you knew how to position yourself in relation to it. The only artist who was able to make it the business of the viewer to think about the things that either other people didn't wish them to think about or they themselves did not wish to think about. And he did it over and over. Now, the last thing is this. It is sort of related to the line. When Leon got towards the end of his painting life, increasingly he began to use texts, and he used sort of voiceovers, and in certain ways he also began to montage things in a way which was previously unseen in his work. And there was a clear source, it was Nancy. And Leon started to, in a sense, assimilate what Nancy had done into the problems of making his pictures. And the results were sometimes quite awkward, and interesting for that. Other times, very, very successful. But in other respects, and they have to do with the touch and with the whole way in which he did his work physically, they always retain the sort of the bigness, the big address, the sort of muscle to the picture, and so on. In these last pictures, actually, Leon frankly enters into Nancy's territory at a point when she could no longer do it herself. By this time, Nancy was doing almost everything by indirect means, by printing, by having people work with her to extract images either from her own work or from other sources and to develop the kinds of tonal subtleties and the kinds of complicated readings that she had done by hand in the Artaud Codex and many others by indirect means. And in a sense, Leon and Nancy kind of trade places. It seems to me that what Leon did was to start to draw in his own way in the territory that she'd been forced to abandon, as he was forced to abandon the territory that he had previously occupied. And you know, there are not that many artist couples who can even stand each other after this many years, but to actually be learning from each other and to do it in a way which sort of didn't in any way undercut the fierceness of both, but that really was dialogue. I mean, there's all this conversation about dialogue, but think of how few dialogues any of us actually have with anybody. And this was a touching end-of-life dialogue where the male painter openly acknowledges his debt to his partner and then proceeds to make work which is a complement to hers and an extension of hers and an extension of his all at the same time. So when I look at these things, I sort of think, oh, this is the whole of that conversation taken to his side of the practice, but with her deeply embedded in it. And it's fascinating. Thank
you. Thank you. Thank you, Susan, Sam, Rob. Doug, it's great to hear from people who knew Leon. I didn't know him personally, so my interpretation of the work comes at a slight remove, but I think that it gives me the resolve that hopefully we're going on the right track here in terms of looking at these late drawings. And I just want to thank you all for coming tonight. Maybe in lieu of doing a Q&A, we'll keep the gallery open until 8, and you know, people can mingle for a little while and just ask questions to any of the panelists that were here, to myself. And again, we really appreciate you coming down, and it's a great crowd, and please enjoy the show. Thank you. Oh, sorry, one last word.
You know, I wrote in, like, pink marker, and I still forgot to thank Brett for pulling this together. It's a remarkable, remarkable exhibition and a great achievement, and it's allowing a lot of people to see the work in a way that probably may not happen again. So thank you, Brett.